Welcome to the USCHoops.com College Basketball Podcast. USCHoops.com College Basketball Podcast is the original podcast covering USC Trojans men's college basketball team and is available on such platforms as Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and TuneIn, as well as at the USCHoops.com website. If you haven't done so already, we'd really appreciate it if you gave us a 5-star rating and left a review on the platform of your choice. Hi, everybody. This is Chase back with another podcast. I hope everyone's having a wonderful summer. It's a Sunday, August 17th of 2025. I'm joined by Nick, as always, and really great to have the special guest back for our third part of what maybe a three-part series, four-part series, we'll have to see, or maybe just kind of continuing series. Upper West Side Trojans with us. Upper West Side, thank you so much for joining us. And just before we started, he had asked Nick a question, kind of talking about how, you know, we're an hour and a fourth different coach since Pete Carroll. And Pete Carroll was a defensive coach. I think he's the only defensive coach that USC has defensive specialist USC has hired in the last 75 years. I've got to go back and check that. I'm not sure if we've hired any other defensive guys to be head coaches. Maybe someone can correct me about that. But definitely he noting kind of the lack of physicality over the last 15 years without Pete Carroll. And, you know, noting sometimes how we have a tendency to what appears to get pushed around some. So, Nick, the question was put to you. You know, do you have any thoughts on what, you know, Upper West Side's observation was about kind of the lack of physicality we've seen the last 15 years and sometimes getting pushed around in the run game?
Well, I think it's smart. You look at the past head coaches we've had since Carroll with Kiffin, Sark, Helton, to a lesser extent, Lincoln Riley even. Like, these are pass happy coaches who are X's and O's guys that try to out-scheme other people. I do think you've seen some physicality with Riley teams, at least at Oklahoma, where they did have a very good run game, but he's never really put together the defensive side. So that's still the question there. And I do think there's something to be said. Like, there was the whole narrative when Graham Harrell came in as OC that if you had an air raid offense, but with 5-star players as opposed to 3-star players, you'd have this unbelievable offense that would be able to outscore everybody. And you could pass 50 or 60 times a game and, you know, be a national championship contender. And that clearly failed. So you look at the top teams across college football. Michigan's won a national title with Harbaugh, and they were a physical team, had good players, but, you know, they weren't pulling in top 5 recruiting classes every year. They were able to do it with quality players and development and culture. And then you have this Ohio State team, which was basically an all-star team where they paid a bunch of their draft eligible juniors a ton of NIL to come back to their senior seasons. And, you know, they had Quinshon Judkins in the portal from Ole Miss come in to play running back, and Travion Henderson was already a top, 40 pick as a running back. So that was just a all-star talent team, I think, combined with good coaching. So there are multiple ways to skin a cat, but I think both recruiting, physicality, and player development are all contributors to building a national championship level program.
Upper West Side, any thoughts?
Yeah, you know, I go back and forth on this with people all the time since probably Pete Carroll left. I think you definitely need skill and you definitely need complex defenses, unique schemes on offense. But I don't think you can really ever win if you don't have anywhere from quite a bit of physicality on your team on both sides of the ball to being really physical. Because even Ohio State's team, those guys were really physical players. They could run the ball. Now, Ryan Day happens to be a fabulous OC who can pass the ball around the yard, and they've gotten the reputation of being a great passing team, so they get those top wide receivers. They also get top running backs and top everybody. And so they do it both ways, but they're definitely physical. I mean, they had the best defense in the country. You're never the best defense if you just sort of out-scheme people. So I always lean on fundamental play and physical play first, and then you build from there. You don't do it the other way. You don't sort of try to win games with outsmarting people and then see if you'll get tough players. And I do think it comes from the head coach. Now, you are right in the fact that Lincoln Riley did have some really good running teams there. So what I've noticed about his offensive lines and even our offensive lines, they do look like they play physical. They push guys hard. They seem to try really hard, at least the offensive line does. So I don't know why that is with Lincoln, maybe because he's an offensive guy himself, but his offensive lines can be physical. Maybe not the most physical in the country, but I really wouldn't call them soft. I say he's kind of gone away from running the ball at USC for his own reasons because he's so brilliant at passing the ball, probably. But I will say that his teams on offense can be somewhat physical, especially the O-line. His defenses, I don't think, have ever been physical. And overall, I don't think his teams are super physical. I do think they were more physical than the Sark, Kiffin, and Helton teams for sure. But when I watch the plays of why another team's getting 8 yards on the ground on every play, I just see the players getting pushed back. And I saw that with Kiffin, Sark, Helton, and I never saw that with Carroll. You know, even in the first year, I think they were pretty decent against the run. So I lead with physicality and fundamental play, and then I think you build from there. I am hearing, though, from my sources, and we're hearing it on, you know, the Peristyle and places like that, that it is a lot more physical this year. And maybe all these new coaches are have free rein to make the players a little tougher because a lot of them have a really good background in football and they've been around a long time and they're quality coaches. So I'm hoping that changes because I certainly think Lincoln Riley has the schemes to do it on offense. And I think Lynn has good schemes on defense too. So that's the only part to me that's lacking. And, you know, we could definitely use a few more trench players, offense and defense, even though the defensive line is definitely going to be better this year.
I think so. You know, you've noticed a progression for definitely the Sark teams and the Sark. You know, Texas was, I think, third in the nation last year in total defense. So you know, there's for Sark, you know, allowing under 300 yards per game. So there's definitely progression there with Sark. Kiffin has really completely changed his philosophy. As I mean, people, there's a lot of citation about Kiffin and when he was our coach. If you look at anything that he's running at Mississippi and what he ran at FAU, they look nothing like the teams that he ran when he was coaching USC, especially when Matt Barkley was the quarterback. Just completely different kind of approach to football, much more run heavy approach to football, much more about physicality. When he got to FAU, Art Briles' son is, I think it's a son, Kendall Briles, was Kiffin brought him in to be the offense coordinator. And really kind of just reshaped, the way Kiffin likes to design offenses. So you still see a hint here and there of the old Lane Kiffin, but it's just a very, very different type of team that he now seeks to run when he's kind of, more mature, I guess, and gone through different phases of his career. So that is interesting to watch. Maybe that we'll get some progress on the defensive side, with Lincoln Riley. I threw out some stats in the Peristyle, gosh, like a month ago, talking about, some of the progress we had made on defense last season. I mean, progress was definitely made, but it's not like it pushed our defense into being even a, defense that ranked in the top half of power conference schools. So there was still quite a long way to go there. And then, this is like a point that we just discuss so often, but it is kind of like, I don't really understand why he passes the ball so much. I mean, I get the idea that you want to pass the ball. I mean, that you don't get me wrong on that. You definitely want to pass the ball for sure. But, last season, if you just go by, rushing attempts per game, there were only five teams that averaged fewer rush attempts per game than USC did, and only two of them, Arizona and Colorado, were power conference teams. So, and obviously Colorado had Shedeur Sanders. There's a whole reason for that there. So, we're 129th out of 134 teams in rush attempts. But if you look at like the teams around it, I mean, this is what's so striking about this. The bottom 15 teams in rush attempts per game last season, they're all terrible running teams. I mean, they're all, I mean, with the exception of like a couple averaged over 4 yards per carry, but for the most part, these are teams that are averaging under 4 yards per carry, some averaging under 3 yards per. Colorado averaged 2.5 yards per carry when they ran the ball. So these are teams that just do not run the ball well. USC averaged 5.16 yards per carry. That was 21st in the nation, and I think it's like in the top 10 for power conference schools. So it doesn't, it just does not compute that we would not be running the ball more. And then there was this, there's arguments that being made, well, we're so successful running the ball because it's a surprise to the defense, where they just expect us to pass the ball all the time. Fair enough, fair point. But the other side of that is, if you actually look, you know, deep into some of these analytics, USC was actually one of the best teams in the country last year running the ball in like obvious run situations, short yardage situations, a third and fourth down. So, which surprised me. I didn't realize that was the case. So we were like top five in the country last year in those circumstances. So it's just really bizarre that some of the decisions. I get some of it with Miller Moss because, you know, he's not going to contribute very much to a running game. And you know, he's really kind of a, he's basically a shotgun quarterback. And then I guess maybe you make the argument with Maiva because he was hurt a lot of the time he was playing quarterback. Apparently, you know, his knee was not in great shape, but still, you'd think you'd want to run the ball a little bit more than we did. We basically had this 60%, 40%, you know, 60% pass, 40% run. Didn't make a ton of sense to me, especially since we were really inefficient passing the ball last season. So, I don't know, Upper West, you have any thoughts on that?
You know, the people I've talked to that are a little bit in the know at USC, they just think that Lincoln really knows the passing game and he loves it. Not that he doesn't know the running game, he does, but it is so easy in his mind to get 10 yards passing the ball versus trying to get 5 yards or 7 yards running the ball. And so he just feels like it's literally guaranteed that every pass will be complete. And so, why ever run the ball? And he's right. You know, he's one of the top guys in the business, maybe even in history, at passing the ball. But I think you need to mix it up regardless, just because you want to keep the defense, you know, off guard. I don't know the reasons. And I don't know about the same thing with the statistics, like we were good at third and one and fourth and one and things like that. Maybe we were, but it did seem like maybe that was during the entire game. But then in the fourth quarter, you'd sort of. We must have failed a lot more because, you know, you and I would also watch every game and we'd notice that we'd be winning the game in the fourth quarter, maybe only by a touchdown, but we were winning against good teams and even average teams. And then it seemed like when we really needed that first down in the fourth quarter, it definitely wasn't there. Or we needed, hey, there's 4 more minutes on the clock. Let's pass the ball a little, but let's run the clock out by running the ball and get a few first downs running it, even though the defense is expecting it. To run the clock out, and we really weren't able to do it. So I don't know. We probably were clutch on third and one and fourth and one and third and two and those kinds of obvious running downs. Maybe we were, but it didn't seem to win us any games. And we never, the other thing is, we never had a game, regardless. You mentioned, I didn't know we were that low in carries per game, but we never have games, regardless of the amount of carries, whether it's 15 carries or 70 carries in a game. We never had a game with like 250 yards or 300 yards rushing. And the best teams you'll see, they'll have games where they only have 190 yards passing and 300 yards rushing. They'll have games with 400 yards passing and only 150 yards rushing or something like that. So we just never see us rely really on the run in a game or just, hey, this is an easy team. We're playing Minnesota. We can push Minnesota around. And so we're going to run it until they make us stop. So when he's doing well with the run, you're right. I don't know why most people think that he just feels like passing is so easy. In his mind, he can complete a 7 yard, 10 yard pass 100% of the time. And he's right most of the time, but not always. So that would be my theory on it.
What I just don't get is, though, it's just so counter to when he took over at Oklahoma. Because if you look at, you know, you can make the argument about, okay, well, Jalen Hurts and Kyler Murray, those are running quarterbacks, so obviously he's going to be running the ball a lot more with running quarterbacks. But with Baker, I mean, Baker is a very mobile quarterback. He's very mobile, but he didn't run for yards. I mean, he never ran for 200 yards in a season playing for Riley, and yet. You know, in 2016, Baker's junior season, Oklahoma averaged, I mean, this is the same team that was averaging, 26 or seven, same coach who gave us like, whatever, 27 yards rush attempts per game last season. And in 2016, Oklahoma is attempting 44 rush attempts per game. 44, it's like almost 20 more. And then 2017, Oklahoma is attempting 39. So I guess maybe it's just a consistent pattern of it went down. I think the following year when Jalen Hurts took over, they went back up again. But still, I mean, 39 is a big departure from 27. So
You know, Chase, to interject for a second, maybe he really felt comfortable with Bill Bedenbaugh or something. You know,
yeah, that's possible. That's
Bill
possible.
Bedenbaugh is supposed to be a really good old line coach, and he maybe ran the ball so well with him that he said, "Oh, this, you do feel more when if you have Reggie Bush in your backfield, you have comfortable giving him the ball a lot, or Lindell White, or any great running back. What's his name? Ron Johnson. He had Ronald Jones, excuse me. Yeah, I think he had 1,500 yards, and I believe that was under Helton, right?
Yes, Sark and Helton, I think Helton, I believe, yeah.
Maybe, yeah, I don't remember if there was the changeover at that point or anything. I think that was a Helton coach
Yeah, it
team.
was, yeah.
And we did have a lot of really good linemen that year. It's true. A bunch of those guys went pro, but maybe he just loved Bedenbaugh. And I know he wanted to bring Bedenbaugh with him, but Bedenbaugh didn't want to leave I'm not sure what the reason was for that, but maybe that's the reason. But maybe we'll see a change this year, because so far it does sound like Hansen's doing a really nice job. But we'll wait till we face Michigan or some other, a Big Ten team, and we'll see where it goes, right?
Yeah. And Nick, any last thoughts before we move on?
Nope, just think you guys covered it.
Okay, so we're picking up, just before we get into this, our kind of projections on how the season might go. Let's just finish off where kind of position groups, because we have the two last position groups that Upper West Side and I have not discussed, and now we have Nick involved too, which is great. First is linebackers. It's the one position group where it's really small these days because teams generally play a 4-2 style now, so you really only get two starting linebackers, and one of them obviously is going to be Eric Gentry. So in his case, we have a guy that when he's played very well. Last year he put up some really big numbers when he was healthy, but he wasn't healthy a ton. Also, at the beginning of the season, they actually, I think, were rotating him off the bench, so that was a little surprising to me, but I think they've locked in now that he's definitely going to be the guy. We obviously have now Rob Ryan as linebacker coach. So, whatever you want to say, Rob Ryan is a lot of experience as a linebacker coach. Hopefully he still has a lot of energy left. And, it's just, on paper, you're thinking this is for just a technical linebacker coach. It's hard to get someone better than that. And then with both kind of starting linebackers moving on from last season, now we finally turn to some of the recruits that we brought in. Desmond Stevens, he's actually, we finally have kind of like a bigger framed linebacker at that position. The first kind of bigger, properly framed guy we've had, I think, almost in the entire Lincoln Riley era. He's, probably legit 6'3", 235, might even be pushing 240. Just a bigger guy ready to take that place. And then, as far as like, the guys backing them up, we've seen some movement. So I'll just throw it over to you, Upper West. Any thoughts on how the, where you see, what you see from these linebackers?
Everyone knows about Gentry. I remember when I looked him up the first time and said, "Oh, we got this 6'6", 200-pound guy who had a pretty good year at Arizona State." And I was like, "Oh, if he can play, he can play." I'm a person who believes you can be a linebacker at 5'8", 220, and you can be a linebacker at 6'5", 250 if you're, a huge linebacker. If you can play, you can play. It has hurt him a little bit in the run game, I think. Taking on bigger players, bigger blockers, it's been hard for him, but the guy does get it done. He just has that ability he's a playmaker, and he's also aggressive, and he's around the ball, and he's a great team leader. He's definitely who you want on your team. He has put on some weight. He's playing most of I think the first year or two, he was playing at around 200 pounds, maybe 205. And I think last year he played about, 210, 215. That was the biggest he'd been, really. And now I know they listed him this year at 225. They said somebody told me or saw it on the message boards that he was up to 228. But if he could play even like in the low 220s, that's still 10 pounds of muscle compared to or size compared to last year. He's been conditioning for a long time. He is definitely bigger, stronger, knows the game, has been watching it a lot from the sidelines. So he's an exciting player. Stevens is a guy who's really talented, and you could see that talent and speed. And he played some last year. He had that great interception, and he looks like kind of like a reminds me of like a Kamari Ramsey, but he's playing linebacker. So I know they love him, and they're giving him the reins to take over as the middle linebacker as a true sophomore, which is that's a prestigious position. So he might have a few growing pains and make a few mistakes against some really good teams, but I think he's a good player, and with his speed, always you're going to have a chance to maybe go pro with, at some point. There's not a lot of depth or at least experience there. We've never seen too much out of Anthony Beavers. He's been here for a while. Jaden Walker is a player that everyone talks about, but he doesn't have experience. They did bring in Robinson as well as a transfer. They're saying some pretty good things about him. So the de I think if there's no injuries, I think you've got a good couple of guys. But with injuries, you'd have some inexperience, and the better teams might be able to take advantage of that. That's how I would describe it.
Nick, any thoughts?
Yeah, I think Ed covered most of it. Stevens is the guy I'm really looking at. Gentry, I think he is what he is. Maybe you get some marginal weight gain on him, but Stevens had some flashes last year and seems primed for a breakout role this year. And if he doesn't really break out, then I think we could be in trouble at the position.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. I think Elijah Nubi has moved back to linebacker, but the fact that they were willing to move him over to end kind of disrupts his development at linebacker is not a great sign for me, but perhaps it's because they liked Walker and then Tamari Robinson, the transfer from Penn State, more. That's a possibility. We also have the two freshmen are kind of interesting. We have the kid that signed very late in the process. He's the one that was out in Vegas. That's AJ Tuitele, I believe it's pronounced. And then Tagoa, or is okay, Tagoa is the one from San Clemente. I'm not even sure how to pronounce his name. So I think both of these guys, isn't the rumor on both of them they showed up to camp at like 205 pounds?
Yeah, Tagoa is thin, but really uber talented, I think. Really, really talented. I didn't know as much about it. He was like a late addition to Tuitele. I know that last name. It seems like there's a Tuitele on a team every year somewhere, but I didn't know much about him. I know he came late in the process. The other guy's a blue chip guy, but he's a little bit more like an Eric Gentry, it seems like. But I think he is really, really talented. But I don't think you want those guys really starting right off the bat unless I don't think you could handle like a big 10 players coming at you when you don't if you're not much over 200 pounds, let's put it that way.
Well, that's true. I mean, look, if you're relying on those guys for some serious playing time, that's probably a really bad sign. The position group is going to be very important, irrespective of, who's actually getting these minutes. If Gentry's able to stay healthy, the linebackers did not perform particularly well last year, in my opinion. I think you saw that with some of our run defensive numbers. I know we didn't have like the greatest killer defensive line, but I think the defensive line actually played pretty well from a standstill point of view. They weren't like teams weren't able to blow gigantic holes in our defense line for the most part, but you did not see the linebackers stepping up and making a lot of huge plays. So, to me, that's an issue. We'll see how that develops. The DBs are supposed to be like, on paper, kind of maybe the best position group coming into the season. It's led by Kamari Ramsey, who I think, he could have gone into the draft. He's coming back for a senior year. Where I don't know, actually, is this going to be a senior or junior? He might even
I
be
think he's
a,
a redshirt junior.
yeah, he actually might have another year. So this is interesting with Ramsey. He's joined by North Carolina State transfer, Bishop
Harvey.
Fitz, yeah,
Bishop Fitzgerald, sorry, yeah.
Bishop, yeah, Bishop Fitzgerald, Bishop Fitzgerald, who also has kind of like high marks. So those two are, I think, are supposed to kind of like anchor this, the secondary. The cornerbacks are a little bit more of a kind of iffy situation. Prophet Brown, I think, was slated to start as the nickel, and then he got hurt. We don't know when he's coming back. I think it sounds like they're plugging they're plugging DJ Harvey, the transfer from San Jose State, into that spot. And then the question is like, who's going to start a cornerback? And then you have guys like DeCarlos Nicholson, who decided not to transfer, decided to come back, didn't look particularly great last season, but getting better reviews. You have Chasen Johnson, the guy who hemmed and hawed. I mean, I think he transferred four times during the offseason. He's from Central Florida. He's on the team. I'm imagining he'll probably play a lot of minutes of cornerback. And then you also have Marcellus Williams. So you're gonna. My guess is we'll be able to put together a pretty decent, at least list of names at DB. I do have some concerns at corner. I think if like DeCarlos Nicholson is like your leading corner, that's a little bit scary. But we'll just have to see how it goes. Like last season, I wasn't like thrilled with some of our cornerback play, especially from John Humphrey, who was supposed to, I thought supposed to be better. So that could be an area to me, a potential weakness. Upper West Side, do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, with the it's a shame about Prophet Brown. He's been working a long time. He's flashed at times and looked like a really good player. He hasn't had the greatest career, but hey, he's a Trojan. He sticks with it. And my thoughts on guys who are not the greatest players, but then they stick around and they work and they work and they work and they don't transfer and they stick it out. I don't, unless you're a really bad player, you can turn out to be pretty good when you're in your fourth or fifth year. So, and he has shown ability to play. And also, anybody who plays under Grinch, you might not develop that well. It's totally understandable. So, I was looking forward to that. But they say, he could be back somewhere between the fourth and seventh game. They're not exactly sure. They're trying to keep, mum's the word on the injury. So, let's just hope he can come back maybe by Illinois or a game or two after that or something, and then have maybe one of those a strong second half of the season. That could happen, and he'll be watching on the sideline, be anxious to get back, and maybe he'll finish his career really strong. He certainly knows everything about football at this point, so I'm praying for him. I wasn't sure why they didn't take somebody like Christian Pierce and maybe try him out at Nickelback, because he's a good player, and but he still seems like he's relegated a second string at safety. So we all know about Ramsey and Fitzgerald. That's really solid duo, I think. Ramsey's such a phenomenal player, maybe almost like the best player on the team, potentially. He's just a great player. At corner, I really did like DJ Harvey at corner, but I guess he's so experienced and versatile enough, and he can move around. Maybe he's one of those kinds of players, kind of like a Ramsey, where he can move around a little bit. And so I guess that's an okay switch. I'm not sure of it. I'm okay with Nicholson. I was very critical of him last year. Yeah, he was really tall and everything like that, but he had a lot of trouble and he had a rough year last year. Now he did come on at the end of the year, the last few games. I don't remember which games, but towards the end of the year, he was decent and he made some pretty good plays and he kind of showed some signs of going from sort of an average player to a good player. Now, everyone's raving about him in camp, so I'm hoping he's one of those guys that sort of played like an average player and now he's going to be big time or at least be a lot better. They are saying good things about him. And, second year, the best thing about this defense overall, we all know, is second year in a system usually huge. You look at all the teams, usually that second year is a big turnaround. So, really looking forward to that. You're right about the corners, though. A lot of sort of talent out of high school. A lot of these guys, a lot of highly recruited guys, no experience for most of them. So I think, well, how would I characterize it? Even with the loss of Brown, I would say it's going to be a good first string. And I would worry a little bit about the second string, because we just don't hear that much. I have heard good things about Kennedy Urlacher. Maybe it makes sense for considering who his father is. He had a few good offers out of high school, so maybe he does turn into something special. I don't know. They've said good things about him. Aside from that, the other guy that I do really like a lot, and I've heard lots of good things, including from a few of my sources, Chasen Johnson. He just needs to learn the system. He's a guy that really should be playing at a bigger school. He belongs. He's supposed to be a very talented player, kind of came out of nowhere last year at a smaller school and became a starter, and that's hard to do even if you are a group of five, and USC wanted him in the portal, so he must be decent. So I think he'll play a lot because I think he's a good cover corner and he's faster than people think. So overall, I'd say a really good first string probably, or a good first string for sure. Second string, I would say I hope we don't have a lot of injuries. Let's put it that way.
Nick, your thoughts?
Yeah, I'm a little concerned about the depth. I also do worry when you have these like fourth and fifth year guys that haven't performed all of a sudden becoming starters. Because I do think they're, as I'd mentioned, like players do continue to grow, but the growth mostly is from year one to year two. And you can say this is the second year in the scheme, and that's true, but that does worry me a little bit. Prophet Brown did flash in that Louisville bowl game, I remember a couple of years ago. I know he made some nice plays there. And obviously we hope for the best for his recovery. Chasen Johnson, I do agree. He's going to be a guy. He started, I think, as a freshman at UCF last year, which is pretty impressive even at that level. So looks like he has, good tangibles, height, weight, speed. And obviously you have Trevon Reed, the new DB coach coming from UCF. So there's familiarity there already. Kamari Ramsey was probably my favorite USC safety to watch in like a decade. So I thought he made so many instinctive plays. So excited to see him back in Cardinal and Golds. So yeah, I mean we'll see. I do think the safety spot's a little bit more certain than the corner spot right now, though.
We do, there's a lot of young guys that really didn't play last season at the cornerback spot. And it's really hard from where we stand. There's so much secrecy. I actually want to talk about that in a second. So much secrecy surrounding the camp. And like RJ Sermons, who's a legacy, a USC player, his dad was, Trojan I played against in high school, Rodney Sermons. He was a five star in the class of or close to a five star top 50 player in the class of 2026, but he moved up into the class of 2025. So he's leaving early. I'm not sure exactly his age. But then you've got guys like Alex Graham coming in from Michigan. He was a pretty, heavily recruited guy. We've talked about Williams. And then there's a guy like like Braylon Conley, who, kind of was, added a couple classes ago, hasn't really done much. I'm not sure if he could ever offer much. So it's just like there's just so much unknowns, because I just feel like there's just not a ton of information that comes out of camp. So I guess we'll just kind of have to see how some of these guys develop, and what the talent level is. So let me ask you, I mean, because this is something I did want to just bring up. He's from Upper West Side, your opinion on this. Is there, I should also mention like Isaiah Rubin also, right? He went to Los Alamitos High School. Is there, like, in your mind, a justification for the near, I mean, I know they have actual, they let reporters go to some of these practices, but they're like not even allowed to say what happens at the practices. I was allowed to go to the summer practices that Eric Musselman was running and actually take video of the scrimmaging. And no one said a thing. No one was like, you can't show that. It was no problem. I put it on social media. It was like no big deal. Is there like a justification for the just like total blackout level of secrecy for what's happening in these camps? I mean, we're the first two games of the season, we're playing teams that are a much lower quality than us. I can't imagine that we need to maintain that secrecy for those two games. And then once we play those two games, you're going to see how the guys actually are. So, Upper West, do you have thoughts on this?
It's a double-edged sword. So on the one side, if you keep everything secret, then nobody else knows about it, and the other team doesn't know about it. And why do the fans need to know about it? But I totally get it. It's sort of like a business decision, but I think it's a mistake because the fans are the ones who, buy the tickets, and we support the teams. And why do we want to know, like, for example, just about say the injuries? Because we want to know. That's we buy the tickets. We want to know, should we expect to king if Lincoln Riley, if all the players are healthy, we want to know. We want to form a real opinion. Well, everyone was injured, so we shouldn't get rid of Lincoln Riley, or we want to know these things. We are entitled to it. We're the fans. So collectively we're entitled, but he makes the decisions and can do whatever he wants. But I mean, the fans are a huge part of the game, collectively, that is, again. So I liked it when it was more open practices. And I wish there was a way they could do it. And maybe when they're running their double secret probation plays, then they could keep those under wraps, or when they're running their trick plays each week. But people are going to know, like, we're still going to run off tackle and we're still going to run bubble screens and things like that. If he's completely changing the offense and defense, maybe, I guess. So you could do it either way, but I still think it's unfair, and you can still mix it up enough, but I do get it. It's a business decision. Would I do it? I don't think so. I mean, some teams practically tell you what they're running. They line up and they say, look, guess what? We're probably going to run it up the middle, and they do. So, but money's involved. Where there's money involved, I think that pollutes the sport a lot, and you get these kinds of decisions. But we don't feel like it's our team anymore, do we? And people who are involved, I mean, that's the reporter's job is to report on things, but there's nothing to report on. So Ryan Abraham and everybody else is just might as well lay off everybody. Really, there's not much to report. So it's always been part of the game, and now it's morphing into this new thing where there's a bunch of other changes going on in college football too. That's the same kind of thing. I can mention them, but I won't go into them. So I would try to figure out a way to keep it a little, some things a little bit secret. And I wish they would tell about the injuries, like, hey, he's got a torn ACL. He's out. I mean, they usually say if it's a year-ending injury, but I don't know. I guess they don't want the other team knowing, like, he might be back mid-season or something. Or so I'm against it, really against what we're doing. I used to like the way Carroll used to run. He used to win a lot of games, and people probably could find out if they really wanted to the kind of stuff that they were running. Didn't seem to matter, did it? He won 10, 11, 12, 13 games every year. So, but maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it's in this new age, you have to treat it completely like a business. So, maybe Nick has thoughts, or you have thoughts on it, Chase.
Well, I'll turn it over to, I have a feeling I know what Nick's going to say, so I'll let him say it, but I have a pretty good idea. But I'm not even a guy that says you need to tell us about the injuries. I'm willing to say, look, these are, still college players, technically amateurs, although that designation seems a little bit silly at this point. But, I'm willing to say, look, don't, yeah, fine. It's, don't tell us, you don't need to give us this gruesome detail about the injuries, fine. But is there a reason you can't post the stats from the scrimmage? I mean, is there a reason you can't like have the beat reporters just give them this give us the assessment of what they see is going on as far as position groups and who seems to be starting and whatnot? I mean to be honest, if I was actually credentialed media for football and they told me, hey, you can come to the practices but you can't report on what you see, I would just say, okay, then I'm not going. I mean, what's the point of me being there if I can't report on what I'm seeing? So, I put it, businesses or whatever, to me, it's just dumb. It's just dumb because it decreases interest in the team. It's dumb. And Lincoln Riley has a tendency to do dumb things. And we've seen this, and I like Lincoln Riley. I've defended him many times, but he does dumb things and he can't get off of it. And we saw that with the situation with the offensive line. We'll discuss that in a second, where he didn't have the ability to be flexible in the negotiation with Pregnon, and we lost him. And then he tries to replace him with a guy who was ineligible. So it was dumb. Okay. So that all being said, Nick, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think Bowden needs complete control of player personnel and complete control of how the program's marketed, because Lincoln Riley's completely alienated the media and lost the fan base with his moves. I think it's just total amateur hour where he thinks he's smarter than everybody else in the room, and he showed that through his play calling and many other things in the past. So he's getting paid $110 million, and he should start acting like it.
Okay, well, there we go. So let's talk about the before we move on, because the whole DJ Wingfield thing, I mean, this is something that I do have a little bit of an insight on because I'm a lawyer, so I can like pop look into the opinion, see what's going on. There was a tentative ruling that was handed out. It was not actually uploaded to the official court system on Friday. So I didn't see it at first, but somebody actually went on the actual website just for the local court. And they, I guess they post tentative orders there. And it's no surprise because this judge, the case had been transferred to another judge who had already kind of ruled on this issue And just so everybody understands, the issue that's really at play here is because this is what the actual law, the lawsuit or the claims are about. It's whether or not, and this is very specific, okay, it's not whether or not Wingfield has played 4 seasons of football or 4 non-COVID seasons. The issue is whether or not the 5-year rule that the NCAA has, you basically have 4 years to play five, or 5 years to play four, excuse me. And you get an extra one for COVID. So now you had 6 years. If their denial of a waiver of that rule to Wingfield was a violation of the Sherman Antitrust Act. And some players have gotten relief from courts on this issue. There was a ruling in a district court in Nevada. It was a federal court that said that also violates the Sherman Act, imposing this rule. The theory goes that basically that for the NCAA to start restricting eligibility based upon things that happened in a completely different organization, that's junior college. So they're operating, and there's actually a couple of them. There's like the National Junior College Athletic Association. That's the big one, but California has its own. For the NCAA to impose rules on eligibility based upon what another what's happened in another organization is essentially an anti-competitive act because the NCAA is taking advantage of its power in the market to restrict competition. That's the way the argument goes. In the case of Pavia, the quarterback, Diego Pavia, he got the original waiver. It was not on the 5-year rule. He got the waiver on whether or not the seasons played at those JUCO at the JUCO level should count against the 4 years you have to play under NCAA rules. And the district court in that case, and this was a case I think that was, I believe it was in Indiana. I'm not positive. I think it was in Indiana. The district court ruled it was an antitrust violation and essentially issued an injunction. The NCAA responded to that by giving waivers to essentially all of the players that had otherwise sought their eligibility being eliminated strictly on the basis of the years played in junior college. Now, it's slightly different when you're talking about how many total years. The logic and reasoning behind the decision in the Pavia case would apply to, in my thinking, would apply just as well to a kid who started playing in 2019, like Wingfield. He started playing at El Camino College in 2019. 2020, he took the year off. 2021, he played at El Camino again. 2022, he goes to New Mexico, gets hurt, plays like one game, missed the entire season. Then he plays one more season, and then he, I think, in New Mexico. Then he transfers to Purdue and plays the season. So a kid like he's only played 2 actual seasons of college football at the NCAA level. So you think, oh, well, he would get the Pavia waiver. The Pavia waiver doesn't apply to this 5-year rule, which is a separate rule saying how many total years, and they run consecutive. It's basically the first year you played, then you have 5 consecutive years to finish your eligibility. I know there have been many waivers about this. The quarterback for Utah is talked about all the time. He's played like 8 years. Well, he's getting consistent waivers from the NCAA. And one of the rules for the NCAA is in order to get a waiver, you need to make academic progress. Apparently, in Wingfield's court filings, he conceded that his last year at Purdue, he did not make any academic progress toward his degree. I think that probably is one of the reasons the waiver was denied. So, I mean, part of this is on Wingfield. Also, if you go to the Purdue website and you look at his player profile, it does not say that he started playing junior college football in 2019. It said he started playing in 2020 and called it a COVID season. Well, we know he actually started in 2019 because you can go to El Camino's roster is still up from that year, and it talks about Wingfield being on the team in 2019. So he was on the team at El Camino in 2019. That's a mouthful. It appears that tomorrow, I think tomorrow is the official court ruling. Yeah, his request for preliminary injunction, I think, will be denied. He'll have to make an emergency appeal to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. I think it's not likely it will be granted. If the emergency appeal is granted, to the extent that the court will at least hear it, they'll hear the argument on an emergency basis or expedited basis, I think there's a greater likelihood that they actually would issue a TRO and let Wingfield play under the theory that, it's not going to harm anybody. But that's a lot. There's a lot of steps between now and then. And I think tomorrow you're going to see a formal ruling by the court saying that Wingfield is not eligible to play this upcoming season. Said a mouthful. Any thoughts on the situation, Upper West Side?
I don't know the legality of it. You know that a lot better. You did a nice job explaining it. It does seem like he should get the extra year. Just, I mean, again, I don't know the laws, but I mean, he's trying to play football. He's trying to go complete a degree. Now, I don't know why he didn't have, do you know what his situation was at Purdue? I mean, he took three classes and failed them all, or how did
Uh,
it,
or, or it's just possible that the classes he took were not in his selected major. That's a, I mean, if you're just in classes and these are kind of like electives and you've already satisfied your elective requirement, you're not actually making, well, I think the NCAA has a whole regime. Nick might actually know about this too, so I'll let it ask him in a second. But the NCAA has a whole set of requirements or whatever criteria for whether or not you're making progress towards your degree. And I believe that Wingfield conceded that he was not making progress.
does he have any kind of degree besides, like, does he have any degree at all right now? He's been around in college a long time, and you'd think if you started in 19, regardless of whether you're playing football, you'd have a degree by now. Does he have an undergrad from somewhere?
Oh, he doesn't. Well, he might have an associate's degree. He does not have a bachelor's degree.
That's a long time. So maybe they kind of look at that. I don't know if that's part of the rule, though, or something like
It is
that.
part of the rule when you're seeking a waiver of the number of years. It is part of the rule that you need to be making progress towards your degree, which kind of makes sense for,
Maybe there's a gray area there that he can get by. I mean, if he has a really good lawyer, maybe they can do something about it, but you seem to feel like it probably won't work, but who knows? It sort of has been granted to some people, but I don't know. I think, of course, I'm a USC fan, so maybe I'm biased. I'm not the right person to ask. But I mean, I know he lost some NIL supposedly because of this. So, do you really want to do that? He wants to play football, and maybe he. I mean, if I were the judge, and if I didn't, regardless of the rules, if I knew that he could take at least 12 credits and graduate, or he would, if he was some way there was that he can graduate this semester or something like that, I would let him do it. If not, if he's still not going to graduate for like 2 more years, maybe I wouldn't. I don't know. But then that's just my sort of personal feeling on it. It's like what a dad would say. So that's not legally what should happen. So I don't know. I mean, you feel like it should go through or you don't. I don't know. It's really
Well, I
more.
think, well, I mean, your approach to it, I think most people would approach it. And honestly, a lot of judges approach it this way too, which is, did the NCAA make a good choice? And unfortunately, that's not really the way it works because the NCAA does have has some sort of level of technical discretion to make this decision, and the court doesn't really have any power to second guess the NCAA unless the NCAA's ruling is some sort of a violation. Now, if the NCAA violated its own rules, that could be a ground. I think the argument here is that they are violating the Antitrust Act. So, because I mean, if they were arguing if Wingfield was actually had satisfied the requirements for a waiver, but the NCAA denied it anyway, that's a different type of argument. Then you're like, okay, here's the criteria. He satisfied it. They're denying the waiver anyway. That's a different lawsuit. They're saying that the criteria, that the entire regime, that the 6 year, the 5 year rule should not even be applying to any years that you spent in junior co at a junior college. And I think there is a certain logic to this in the sense that if you take the Pavia decision on its face, now remember the Pavia decision is not a court of appeals or let alone a Supreme Court decision. It's the lowest federal court, it's the district court. But it's still it was powerful enough that the NCAA decided to start granting waivers on the basis of this decision that the district court issued. And it's currently up for appeal before the circuit court. That's a different circuit, it's the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals that's going to hear the Pavia case. Which will be interesting because if the Sixth Circuit rules that the NCAA's rules regarding time spent in junior college is an antitrust violation, almost all this becomes moot because I think at that point in time then you have to revisit this. But the argument Wingfield is saying is like, look, when I started playing post high school, I'm playing in junior college. I didn't start playing for the NCAA until the year 2022, when I played a game for New Mexico and got hurt. That 5-year rule should start then, not in 2019 when I played in the junior college. And the reason is because the NCAA should not have the power to force kids into the NCAA's time clock if they want to play at a lower in a different organization under different rules. There is a little bit of a, there is an anti-competitive element of this for the NCAA to come around and say, look, we're the big show in town. We get to determine what eligibility is, irrespective of when you started playing for us or how many years you're playing for us. If you're playing for this other organization, we consider that counting toward the NCAA years, even if it's a completely different organization than us. So it's an I'd really want to think about that a lot longer. It's an interesting argument. Antitrust arguments are always fraught with peril because it's tough to know what are the really legitimate ones. I mean, it's tough to even it's tough to even have college football if you're not anti-competitive for some level. I mean, can you imagine if some people started complaining about, well, we think in this game the game clock should be 68 minutes, not 60 minutes, and for you to impose a universal game clock at 60 minutes, that's anti-competitive. You need a level of anti-competitiveness just to even have college football. So, there's that element to it. I've talked a lot. Nick, you have any thoughts about all this stuff?
Yeah, it's interesting. I thought the argument that DJ was that it cost him earning potential was interesting, particularly. It kind of reminded me a bit of like the Terrell Pryor and the Denard Robinson lawsuits. I don't know if you've seen any of those where they said NIL wasn't a thing when we were around. Now that it's a thing, we're entitled to money. So I don't think that's likely to go anywhere. Really curious to see how it plays out, but I think regardless, it's a big blow for the offensive line, which was already a question coming into the season. And I think if this is just going to highlight the Emmanuel Pregnon loss even more.
Yeah, absolutely the case. And look, I don't know if there is a relationship between the hire of Bowden and loss of Pregnon. I suspect there's no relationship at all. But obviously we lose Pregnon. It was a huge loss at the time. I remember, and for our rival now, I mean, Oregon is a serious rival for USC. Because we're going to end up playing them at basically every other year. They're one of the few teams in the Big Ten that we're going to be playing so often. So they're like a regional rival for us within the conference. For them to just take a player, a marquee player, basically, arguably our best returning offensive player, maybe not our best, but arguably our best returning offensive player right off our roster in a position of need and pluck him out there, especially when he'd already made the kind of he already made some sort of financial arrangement with USC to stay. That was rough. Apparently, I mean, it's really doubly rough because it appeared that if we just had our financial house bet in better order, we could have easily afforded to pay him. So that whole situation and there seemed like there was a lot of ego involved in letting that happen. To me, that strikes me as just a critical mistake, and I don't think that's something that Bowden would ever let happen today. But that's just my opinion. Upper West, do you have any thoughts on that part of it?
I never found out that, I do talk to a few people, every month or two about what's really going on behind the scenes and stuff, but I never heard what the reason was. I did hear that Oregon had big NIL and we didn't have the same amount of money or couldn't come up with it or didn't want to. And I hear a lot of different stories about sometimes the players are a little aggressive and their handlers and people like that kind of come in and they don't even deal with it themselves because they don't want to deal with it. So you go talk to Lincoln Riley or you go talk to the team over there and get me $1 million. They said, yeah, I'll do it, of course. So I don't know. I didn't hear exactly what the case was with him, but the only thing I heard was that Oregon had more money. That's what I heard. That's
Yeah.
it.
I mean, I think it's hard to come up with any other reason other than Oregon had more. Oregon's offensive line coach is Leak Terry. He was previously a defensive staff assistant staff for the Vikings. He's a young guy, not a lot extensive experience coaching offensive line. So, you can't really use the argument that Pregnon left because he thought the coaching at the offensive line was going to be so much better in Oregon. I mean, I think he just left for the dollars, and I think there was a lot of personal stuff got mixed into the negotiations. And that kind of thing, you got to hold on to a guy like him. I personally feel unless you've got somebody lined up to come in to replace him, that is just rock solid. And they clearly had not done their due diligence on Wingfield. I mean, there's just no question about it. I think they were really blindsided by this whole situation. I'm somewhat sympathetic because if you go on his, the Purdue profile, you would not have seen any obvious problem with him playing in 2019. But it's something, you dig a little deeper, and he's playing under his, on his Purdue profile, he's going under the name DJ. But if you go back to his El Camino profile, it's under his real name, which is Duanier Wingfield. So, it would be nice if they had figured out, hey, this kid actually had graduated from Redondo Union High School in 2019. Is there a reason that we think he's eligible? Just some thoughts. Okay, if let's just we've gone on for about an hour. I don't know. Upper West, do you want to do some predictions on this upcoming season? What do you want to do?
Sure. I love all this stuff, as you know.
Okay, so let's just go through, USC schedule here. We open up the season with what used to be Southwest Missouri State. Now they're called Missouri State. This is, I think, their first year in FBS. They're an FCS school up until now. So this is technically an FBS game. Very strange opponent to have. This was the game that was supposed to be against Ole Miss, I believe, and we backed out. I would just assume we're going to win this game. I don't know exactly what's going to happen. Game two is against Georgia Southern, and the coached by Clay Helton. Georgia Southern should be quite a much better team than Missouri State. I know people keep saying, "Oh, Georgia Southern's also a Division One AA school." Yes, they used to be, but they've been an FBS school for the past 12 years, and they've been decent enough. I mean, this is not like a powerhouse program, but like the Sun Belt, which they did pretty well in last year, had a pretty strong season, actually, in some ways better than even the Mountain West. So Georgia Southern is going to be they're going to come. Geared to play. They're a much better team to me than Missouri State is. We should still win that game very comfortably. And if we don't, it's probably a signal as a problem. But the Missouri State is about as weak of a team as you're ever going to see USC play, in my opinion. Georgia Southern is more of a comp to probably, I'd say somewhere between San Jose State and Fresno State. I mean, I could be as good as Fresno State. We've played Utah State in the past. I think that's an interesting comp. Upper West, any thoughts on those two games?
I don't worry too much about those teams. If you can't beat them, then there's a problem. But, Helton has done okay over there. He's even at that level, he's probably a pretty good recruiter. And they've been above 500 and they've done okay. They've been, kind of like he was at USC, win a couple of decent games, lose a couple of decent games, sort of have a few runs here and there. And I think Georgia Southern is, you still want to prepare for them. Clay Helton is experienced. It's at home too. If you're playing all the way down in Georgia, or something like that, that could be a different story. You never know. You get it. There could be an upset, but I think it would be hard for them. And I think you should be able to just run the ball on them and stop the run and those kinds of things. And you could play tighter coverages with them and all that. So I see the first challenge is going to be Purdue, but then again, I don't really think this year I don't think Purdue will be very good in their first year. They have a new
Well, let's
QB.
hold off on Purdue for a second.
But
Let me,
anyway.
Nick, do you have any thoughts on the first two?
I'll just echo what Ed said originally. Upper West said, I think that Georgia Southern and Missouri State are easy teams. If you can't beat them, then you're in trouble.
Yeah, so let's talk about Purdue and Michigan State because I see that as like the next block. Purdue was ter absolutely terrible last year. It is a road game at distance, where we're playing West Lafayette. It is likely to be, I think it's an early game. 12:30 Pacific time, so we're not, it's not like it's a morning Pacific Coast time, but it's an interesting, it's going to be an earlier in the day game. The problem for me on this game is like, yes, this should be a game that USC wins for fun because of just how bad Purdue was last season. But we have to understand that while Purdue went 0-9, Maryland went 1-8, and their one win was at home against USC. So nothing is a given in these situations. This will be an important game to know whether or not we're going to be like in a 7-5 team, 6-6 team, or even worse, or potentially could be, 8-4 or better. So that's my thought on Purdue. Michigan State at home. I think Jonathan Smith is a pretty good coach. USC should beat Michigan State at home. I don't think that should be a really difficult game to win over the long over the course of an entire game. Upper West, your thoughts on those two games?
The Purdue game, I always think away games that are far away, no matter who you're playing, it can be tough. So, because you're just off, and they have Division I players as well, but they do have a new coach who was did a nice job at UNLV. UNLV is not, true Division I. It's, a level down. But with a new QB, ironically, it's funny, they recruited quite a few good linemen or linemen that didn't do well at big schools. They've got one from like Georgia, one from Notre Dame, and some kind of highly rated guys out of high school who were at bigger schools. And they've made, I don't know much about their NIL. I never dealt with them when I was dealing with NIL, so I don't know. It is a road game. I still expect USC is a more veteran team, and they've had the same coach now for several years. They got to win that game. I will predict that they will win that game. So whether it's by a point or 40, I don't know. Maybe they'll win by 20. Michigan State, though, is a different story. I do like Jonathan Smith. He kind of turned Oregon State around. Didn't always have a lot of talent. And so I kind of believe in Jonathan Smith, and I like him as a coach and as a person and everything else. And when I analyzed their team, I'm looking at my page right here. In my opinion, I have them ranked 19th in the country this year, based on everything. They have a lot of returning starters on offense and defense. They have 186 returning starts on defense. They've got several moderately talented players that look good to me, and I do a full analysis. It takes me almost 1 hour to do it on each team. So I think if we're playing away, that'd be definitely a pick 'em game. But at home, it's a win. It's too far away for Michigan State, and so I just don't think so. I just know it's not going to happen for them. Sorry. So I don't know what the score will be, but I don't know. I'll say we're going to win by 14, 17, something like that. Maybe more, because home games, and when they have to travel, that's my thoughts on that particular game.
Nick, thoughts on Purdue? Purdue, obviously, big revenge game for DJ Wingfield and Michigan State.
Yeah, Purdue's a win. I think that's one of the worst programs in the Power Five right now. Michigan State also a win. Home, don't think there's going to be any problem there. And they haven't really found that level of competitiveness. Even under Mel Tucker, they got close, but they're nowhere near like the Mark D'Antonio Michigan State teams. So I'll go with USC.
Okay, so the first really tough game of the season is we're playing at Illinois. This apparently is supposed to be the big noon kickoff for Fox, which makes it even kind of trickier because even though we're playing in daylight, so we're not under the lights, it's 9 a.m. local time in the Pacific Coast. So it is going to be a tricky kickoff here. I think it'll be 11 a.m. local kickoff even for Illinois. So that's even early for them if that's when the game actually kicks off. Illinois, they're kind of a trendy team. If you look at projections, a lot of analysts are kind of projecting them to be very strong this season. They went 10-3 last year. I mean, so this is a team that went 10-3, beat a pretty good South Carolina team in the bowl, won a lot of close games. I'll talk about that in a second because they're kind of the other side of the coin from what USC did last year in the close games. But they have a really strong returning offensive line. That could cause some issues for us, I think, especially them playing at home. Luke Altmyer, the quarterback, I think a lot of people like him as a kind of a game manager who can also hit some big passes at key moments. I could definitely see this being an issue. I think they will try to cram the ball down, run the ball down our throat. I think that's what they're going to try to do. Certainly, their coach Bielema is kind of known for that. The one thing I will say about this team is they're 10-3, yes, but if you start digging down in the numbers in their games against other power conference teams, they were outgained by 40 yards per game in those games. So they are winning games that on paper, just paper, you're looking at the results, they should not be winning these games, and they're winning them anyway. That a lot of times that goes to maybe clutch plays, but also a little bit of luck involved too. They have a lot of returning starters, but and I think just the way I picked games this season, I would have Illinois winning, but Illinois is a team where this is a team that plays a lot of close games. I think this is a game that's going to go down to the wire. Upper West. Any thoughts?
I did a long analysis on Illinois. Everyone knows I use my Phil Steele and I mark it up, and I spent a long time. They're the most experienced team in the entire country. They have the most career starts returning. They don't, on paper, they don't have any talent, or what USC fans would be so unhappy with their roster, because they wouldn't be unhappy with winning 10 games. They'd be pretty happy with that, but they would never like any of their players because they were all three stars. But still, when you have fifth-year players who've been around a long, long time and had a pretty good year against a very weak schedule last year, I mean, they really were an 8-5 team last year if they'd had a better schedule. But still, even an 8-5 team, when you return everyone, maybe that's a 10-3, a legit 10-3 team. Their quarterback has been starting for 20 years. They have 245 career starts returning on offense, which is means literally, if you average it out, every player has started for 2 years prior to this year. Defense, 182 career starts. That's a year and a half of starting. Wow. I mean, it's impressive. Their depth is great too. I make notes on all these things. I put they have good running back, a good quarterback, but I put they have average and weak talent, and they're deep. They have eight players in the second team who have started a lot of games. Eight is a really good number for your defense. It means almost every position you have an experience guy. On defense, I have a seven, which is also pretty good. And talent-wise, they're decent, but not that good. So I really like their team a lot, especially at home. It's definitely a pick'em game because USC certainly is more talented. Can they really stop our offense? If we're on, I don't think so. So it depends. Are we a better team this year? Are we markedly better? If we do, we win. If not, it's going to be difficult because they are a really, really, they kind of remind me of the Oregon team, which was more talented from 4 or 5 years ago when they, that 11-2 team, although that team was a notch more talented for sure. But that's a scary game. And so I could see somebody, if I was going with Lincoln Riley's track record, I would pick them. But I'm hoping the new coaches and stuff are going to make a difference, and we win it by hopefully by 1 point. That's good enough for me.
Nick, any thoughts on this Illinois game?
Chase, what year is this for Lincoln Riley? This is year four.
This is year four, yes.
So how crazy is it that in year four USC starts the season unranked and Illinois is number 12? Isn't that just wild?
It is wild. It is wild.
Yeah, no, it's crazy. My favorite gambling guy on Twitter, Brad Powers, thinks that Illinois is one of the most overrated teams and that actually USC is one of the most underrated teams. But then again, you're coming from the starting point of Illinois being number 12 and USC being unranked there. So I agree with Ed. I don't think Illinois is very talented. At the end of the day, it's Illinois. I don't see a lot of NFL players on that team. Their running back transferred to Georgia, I believe. They won a lot of close games. They were a very lucky team. So it wouldn't surprise me if they were the same caliber of team that they were last year, but their record was maybe 8-4 or 7-5 because they perform, not quite as well in close games. That being said, Lincoln Riley's shown a total inability to win close games himself, especially on the road. So it's absolutely a game that USC as a program should win, but it's hard to be confident that USC will win it. So I think it's a toss-up.
So I kind of separated that game out because that was like our first really, kind of the big, hopefully the big test of the season. But it's part of like a four game set that I really gonna determine, how the season goes. After that, we have a week off, but then we play Michigan at home. Then the following week we're in South Bend. That's gonna be a very, very difficult game. And then the week after that, or actually we have a week another week off, which is nice. But then we go to Lincoln for a blackout game in Nebraska. These are going to be three very difficult games, and I have not, I picked USC to go 7-5, so I'm not, and I'm not like a hard 7-5, but it, like that's just that there's a reason I picked that, based upon some people inside the program with the predictions they were making at different times. So I definitely think we will struggle through this part of the season, maybe go 1-2, or if you include the Illinois game, 1-3 through this part of the season. I winning in South Bend these days, especially under the lights, the game's already going to be, it's a 4:30 local game. It's 4, sorry, 4:30 Pacific time game, so it's a 7:30 local start. I think it's basically almost impossible for USC to win these games right now. Maybe in a couple of years, if we're still playing Notre Dame, we'll have the ability to do that. But it's a very tough game, just given weather and the realities of playing in South Bend. It's just a very difficult game to win. It's hard for me to imagine us winning it. At Nebraska is going to be a huge game this season because if we're doing well, other than maybe in the Notre Dame game, this will be a really tough challenge for us. We've won in Nebraska in the past, so it's a doable to win that game. We obviously beat them last year with Maeva starting, but it was a fairly competitive game. Nebraska should probably be pretty good this season. But this stretch is going to be very, very interesting. Upper West, what are your thoughts on these three games?
Yeah, the only good part of it is there's a lot of buys in there to get guys healed up, and who knows, maybe you get Prophet Brown back just in time if that helps. Who knows, maybe not. You're right that I would agree that you see big jumps early on. You don't see as many jumps, like a guy doesn't go from his fourth year and all of a sudden an All-American in fifth year. But I do think there is, when you have an entire team that's veteran and has been good the year before, I think because they're a little bit better, just a little bit better each, collectively, a team can go from a good team to a really good team. So that's why I kind of think Illinois is good, not because of talent necessarily, just because they're such an old team and they were good last year. But yeah, this stretch is going to be really tough. So hopefully we can beat Illinois. Michigan at home, because there's a bye, I think we're about equal level of talent as them, somewhere like that. And I think that's a home game. I think we're going to win that one. At Notre Dame, wow. Be really hard to pick us to win that one. I can't agree more on that, because no matter who it is, even if it was Alabama or Georgia playing at Notre Dame is really hard at home. You're really going to have trouble running the ball on them at home, and they're going to run the ball well at home. So are you going to rely on the pass game to win it? Are you going to blow their defensive line or off the ball? I don't think so. So that would be tough. Could it happen? Could we out-scheme them and out-hit them? Sure. But on the road, it's going to be tough. So I would probably call that a loss for sure. Nebraska, I like the week off. It gives you a little more time to prepare with the travel and everything. But I think Nebraska, yeah, they're going to be a lot better this year. People forget they weren't very good last year. They did play a lot of close games, but Rule can coach. I mean, he already coached at Baylor and Temple. He didn't do well in the pros. But he's a good coach. I mean, they're returning. They have a lot of career starts returning. They definitely have more talent, in my opinion, than, say, an Illinois team. And they have about 316 career starts returning, which is a lot. It's even distributed offense and defense. Raiola was a guy that Lincoln Riley thought was God, to the point where he barely recruited anybody else. He just said, "This is my guy. I'm taking him. He's mine." And we didn't get him. NIL and other factors. So Raiola, he could probably play. I mean, the guy did come in and start as a true freshman. He might be really, really good this year, after the growing pains. So Nebraska on the road, that could be that they might be better than Illinois. So that's another tough game. So I would love to say we win 3 out of 4, but I might even be happy just to go like 2-2. Let me see where this the stretch is. Yeah, I mean, well, Illinois, Michigan, Notre, yeah, those four games, I might even be happy to go 2-2. That's tall. Three of those games are away. So if Lincoln Riley improves on the road and he figures out a way to do something on the road this year, we're going to pick up some road victories and going to have a great season. If we still can't win on the road and win in the fourth quarter on the road, it could be just like you said, it could be a similar record to last year.
Nick, you have any thoughts on this stretch?
A stretch, obviously. Nebraska, I agree. I do think that's a harder game than Illinois for the reasons Ed outlined. I would look at Raiola coming back. Rule, I think, is a very good coach. He proved it at Baylor. I'm buying them. They also have a great crowd there, a really good crowd. So that's going to be a very tough game. Notre Dame, we would also pencil that in as a loss, although Northern Illinois did beat them in South Bend. Just want to throw that out there last year.
Yeah, in September in a day game though, so that's important
Fair,
here.
fair, fair, fair. Yeah, then Michigan. Bryce Underwood's going to be the quarterback there. I like Sharon Moore as a coach. I thought they were better than their record indicated, and they beat us without having a quarterback that can complete a downfield pass last year. So I think that was actually impressive. Home's a different ball game there, though. That is at the Coliseum, so I would lean USC in that game. I would probably lean Nebraska in the Lincoln game, and then Illinois. That's kind of the key one for me, I think there. So 2-2. If you split, Michigan and Nebraska, and then you can beat Illinois and lose Notre Dame, you're at 2-2. So I would say 1-3 is probably more likely than 3-1. So I would take 2-2, but curious as to your thoughts there, Chase.
Yeah, I mean that's tough. I mean the problem is once you these days it's all about not losing more than two, right? Trying to make it to the college football playoff, and it's very difficult to pull that off by having a third loss. If you have the two losses and one of them is Notre Dame, then you're kind of in the conversation. Even if, of course, then you have the issue of you might go to the Big Ten title game if you were to do something like that. I don't really have us doing that, so I'm kind of in this period where I think there's a
Also, Chase, do we know if this is the last game in South Bend that we're going to play? Is
well
there
this is the
clarity on
last
that?
this is the last game I think that's on the schedule. I don't even think next season's game's on the schedule yet,
So that's
so
notable too. I mean, for a
yeah,
lot of
so
reasons.
yeah, but I think they'll work out something is my guess. They'll work something out, I believe. Northwestern in Iowa, I'm going to put those as a short block here. These are must-win games at home. I mean, it's a little bit like Michigan State. These are, not bad programs, generally speaking, although Northwestern wasn't, too much last season. Iowa is, usually pretty strong. You do have a lot of you do have a lot of talk chirping from Kurt Ferentz about Lincoln Riley for whatever reason. So I have a feeling Lincoln Riley probably has that game circled on the calendar to make sure he sticks it to just to Kurt Ferentz there is my guess. And that will lead into the last two games. So we just really quickly, Ed, do you have any thoughts on the Northwestern Iowa games?
Yeah, when I saw Northwestern, when I looked at their numbers, I didn't even put them in the top 25. So they're one of the few teams that I didn't do an analysis on because I didn't feel like I needed to. I usually do the top 40 teams, and I had them outside of my top 40. So no, they don't worry me. Iowa, really good at home. I might even call for a loss there at home. They're really good, and they play great defense. They run the ball. They're an old school team, and they do win at home. But when they go on the road, it's a little different. So that's a loss for them. And so I don't know why I didn't hear about Ferentz talking smack or whatever. Maybe because they AF physical this the last time we played. I think Helton was the coach the last time we played, and they pushed us around and made us look like a lower tier team. Because I mean, it was embarrassing. I was watching a lot of 8 and 10 yard runs by their team against us, and it was pretty embarrassing. So I don't think the players will remember that because that was a long time ago. But it's a home game. And they don't have the greatest NIL, and that's a loss for them. So that's two wins right there at Oregon.
Well, hold on. We'll just get Nick's thoughts on
Okay,
these two
yeah.
before
Go
you
ahead.
move
I'm
on.
sorry.
Nick, any thoughts?
I think they're wins. The Iowa game especially, if we don't win that game, I think you start questioning whether Lincoln Riley's the coach moving forward.
Yeah, that's so the problem with Lincoln Riley now in year four is some of these games start to look existential if you lose them, because you just can't, after a season like we just came off of, you can't really lose some of these games. Okay. Oregon, at Oregon. Okay. One of the really tricky things about, everyone talked about how I agree last year's schedule, I think, was kind of brutal. And this year's schedule is not as difficult as last year's. But if you were to put the two schedules together as one block and say, what are the two toughest games here? And I would pick out at Notre Dame, at Oregon. So even though this season has got the easier games overall, the two toughest are here. And I think Oregon is the other one. The Oregon thing, I mean, Oregon has been a very strong program the last few years, and they have a ton of talent. They've obviously spent a lot of money on this roster. It is, they have guys that we've had like Bear Alexander and Emmanuel Pregnon. I think they'll be very good. I think their offensive line is going to be brutal, really tough. There is an aspect to this of, what is the situation with Dante Moore? I do think he's the kind of guy that he will gradually get better every season when he's playing. I don't know though how strong he's going to be at the beginning of the season for Oregon. I think that could be an issue for them. Having Dylan Gabriel last year really kind of like, kind of calmed them as a team. This was a debate that we had had offline, Nick, and I think Nick was right that, Dylan Gabriel, it was the right choice for them to make to bring him in. I think the issue though for Oregon is, when they got to that, when that they got to that second game against Ohio State and they had some injuries on the offense, Dylan Gabriel at that point has a bit of a ceiling to me, and you kind of saw that show up a bit there. So, I mean, obviously the loss was not on him. I mean, the defense just got railroaded that game by Ohio State, but he was a very stabilizing factor for their team last year. He kind of fit what they were trying to do really well. Really a kind of an aggressive run team that threw a lot of kind of horizontal passes, get the receivers in these, quick passes to the receivers. Then, mix up and throw the ball downfield. Gabriel did that really well. I'm curious about Dante Moore. I don't know. I do think, though, we're not playing Oregon until the end of November, and it's going to be up in Eugene. And that means weather's going to be a factor. So it's just going to be a very difficult game. Upper West Side thoughts.
Oregon's pretty loaded. They've been loading up for several years, as you know, through NIL, and they've got a lot of good players. I don't know what to think of Moore either. He was really up and down, which most quarterbacks are. When he was a freshman at UCLA, he was a huge recruit. I know we didn't really recruit him. Don't know why. He was supposed to be a great guy coming out of, high school, but he is starting at Oregon, and they have other players too, so he'll probably be pretty good, I assume. He is second year in the system, and I don't think he'll be bad, but he might be great, bad. I don't really know. But the rest of the team, regardless, they have a lot of veterans. 205 career starts returning on offense, that's a lot. The one good thing for us, bad for them in my opinion, is four transfer starters on the O-line. You don't always come together right away in that first year when you have that many transfers. Now, we have some of that too, so that hurts us as well, but it is true. I don't like teams that are loaded with first-year transfer guys. Second-year transfers, that's different. But first-year transfer, I don't like it, especially on the O-line. The big thing with me with O-line is you're hardly ever going to be a good offensive line if you don't play together for 1 year and then play the exact same position and then play again one more year. That's like night and day. That's what I've seen through many, many years of analyzing this stuff. So I love the fact that four of the five guys, including their left tackle, they're pretty good transfers and all that, but still four transfers. I don't like it. But the talent is there. The defense returns 160 career starts. A lot of talent there as well. It's in Oregon, so no matter what, I would probably pick Oregon. But, with the Notre Dame game and Oregon games, and we haven't beaten these teams much lately, maybe there's a little revenge factor. They say that, oh, you shouldn't play that way, but it's human nature to want to beat somebody badly and maybe try a little harder. I don't care what the reason is that you win, just win. So I would still have to go, of course, with Oregon. I mean, they have definitely a notch more talent than us. Like a good, they're a 4 to 5 star team, and we're sort of a high 3 to mid 4 star team as far as talent goes, in my opinion. And and it's in Oregon. At home, I think we could win that game. Close, but we could win it. At away, it's a loss.
Where are you, Nick, with Oregon? As they have pretty favorable schedule, out of conference, Montana State, they have Oklahoma State, but it's at Austin, at Autzen, Oregon State. Then they do have to play at Penn State. They've got Indiana at home. I think they'll win that. Their schedule is pretty favorable. I mean, they end the season with Washington. That's a usually tough game for them to play in Seattle. I kind of think that there is some vulnerability with this Oregon team, but I'm just not sure there's any like there's strong enough teams in their schedule to really take advantage of it.
That's right, Chase. I would look at that Penn State game as a loss for them. I know Penn State's been getting some love in some publications as a possible preseason number one. It is notable that there is not really a clear-cut number one this year at all. I think you can make the case for several teams. So I think that's a tough game for them. They've gotten really good quarterback play the last couple of years with Bo Nix and then with Dylan Gabriel. I thought they ran those systems extremely well. And you saw Nix have a lot of success in the NFL with the Broncos last year. So I think they're taking a step back to Dante Moore. He was very highly rated, but I think it's worth noting that that was the class with Jackson Arnold and Malachi Nelson. So I think a lot of those quarterbacks were pretty overrated that year. And we'll see if Arch Manning pans out and becomes a possible number one pick this year with Texas. That'll be interesting to see. But I think Oregon does take a bit of a step back talent wise. They lost a lot of guys from last year's team. Tez Johnson, Jordan Burch. I think they lost a couple other D linemen. Josh Connerly, who USC fans are familiar with, was a pretty high pick for them as well. So they're reloading. Some questions of quarterback. So wouldn't be surprised if they ended up being more of a top like 15 team as opposed to a top five team this year. But still, I can't confidently pick USC in this game in Eugene.
Yeah, and just to kind of put a bow on Oregon, like it's to me, it's kind of interesting that they seem to really be replacing the guys they've lost with, for the most part, transfers. And I know, Dante Moore was a freshman transfer, so to speak, transfer, but so he's not really in the same category as, let's say, Pregnon or Isaiah Word, who's transferring over from Penn State, Nevada. I don't know why I said Penn State. But Oregon had recruited a whole bunch of really top flight high school guys the last 3 years, and they don't really seem to be like cracking into, at least what we're, it's hard to tell for sure, right? But they don't really seem to be cracking into these, like into the depth chart at the high positions. I guess we'll see how that develops over time. I'm sure some of these guys will end up flashing. I just do see a little more vulnerability here from Oregon, but for us to play them in late November in Eugene, that's just not an ideal situation. Upper West, I'll let you comment on that when you comment on the last game, which is UCLA. To me, I mean, I think UCLA will be better. Obviously, they have Nico now, quarterback. I get that gives them like a legitimate weapon, a quarterback. I still think it's a game where USC really kind of needs to win that game, and I don't think UCLA will be. They could be like a 6-6 team. I don't think they'll be particularly strong. So I'll turn it over to you.
I have UCLA also at 7-5 or 6-6. I see my record written right here with quite a few losses. And so those are the two records I picked for them. I did not put them in my top 25. They're playing at USC. That's a loss. I mean, I could go into depth. Their talent is actually, they've got a few decent players there, but I just don't see it. Not this year. They have some tough games on their schedule too. So they're going to have a lot of good teams they have to play. And they're going to come in with four or five losses against us anyway. So maybe, so I don't think that's too much to worry about. Nico, maybe he'll make a difference. He's a very, very good quarterback. He probably will be in the NFL at some point. I don't think he's a first round guy. I don't think he's quite there, but I think he will get drafted. So they could be a challenge, but I think we win that game. It's at home. Back to what you guys were saying at Oregon, they're always hard to tell like how good Oregon's going to be, and they have had some kind of easier schedule. So to me, their record's not quite as good. But I will point this out, and people, on the boards get really upset when I say good things about Oregon. But I'm not going to say bad things about a coach who, even though I don't like Lanning at all personally, I'm not going to say anything about his coaching when he goes 10-3 in his first year, 12-2 in his second year, only losing to the runner-up for the national championship, Washington. They lost to them twice, but they did lose to only that team. They went 12-2, and then last year 13-1, only losing to the national champion, and beating them once as well. So say what you want about anything about them. That sounds like if you looked at that record, you'd be like undefeated this year. Now, I don't think they will be because a brand new QB who we're all a little bit not unsure of or not high on. That's an issue. I don't like a lot of the transfers they have. You mentioned some of the development of high school guys hasn't been as good for them, but whatever, they're winning a ton of games. I mean, that trajectory sounds like undefeated. I have them ranked a little bit higher than Nick, maybe. I have them in my book finishing ninth in the country. I think they're actually better than that. I have them being about the seventh or sixth best team. I have my two ratings of what I think there will be at the end of the year based on like AP or college football playoff. And then how good do I really think they are? I think because they're like the third, fourth most talented team in the country, they're probably and have a newer QB, I have them at sixth or seventh. So that's kind of how I feel about them. So yeah, and it's too bad that game is up there. Somehow we played them up there a couple of years ago too, which doesn't make sense, but I don't make the schedules. So, but UCLA is definitely a win, so that's a good way to close out. But maybe there's a revenge factor and we can go up there and beat them. They are beatable. They can be beaten, but they only lose once or twice a year, so I don't know.
Nick, any thoughts on that or UCLA?
Think we should beat UCLA. I like the Nico pickup for them, regardless of the circumstances of how it happens. I just think that the common theme here with the entire schedule is if USC were a little bit better, like a possible borderline top 10 team, they could very easily go 10-2. But like kind of once you know, if you're more of a top borderline top 20 team, a lot of these road games become that much harder to win. So the key for the program is you really have to get back to that potential top 10 level before even talking about being a title contender.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think, just going back, just my final thoughts on the Oregon thing is, you just look at the schedule, it just doesn't, to me, doesn't look very difficult. And I'm trying to pick out like, well, what are going to be the tough games? Like, who are the teams that could be like surprisingly good teams on their schedule? Indiana had a great season last year. I don't think they'll be as good this year, but let's say they're really good again. Well, Oregon has that game at Autzen, and Wisconsin, maybe Wisconsin would be a little better. Well, that's another game at Autzen. Now, interestingly, they do play Iowa at Iowa City in November. So that is a game I think theoretically Oregon might lose. There are not a ton of games where I look on the schedule. Like if they had to play Minnesota in Minneapolis in November, I'd say like, okay, that's a potential loss. But they're playing at home. So other than the Penn State game, you're not seeing a lot of losses on this schedule. How many home games do they have? One, two, three. Four, five, six, seven. I guess just
Seven.
seven. Yeah. The last game of the season too, Washington, at Seattle could be tough. I mean, that's a tough game for them. So that actually puts a little bit more pressure because otherwise I'd say the schedule is very, very favorable for Oregon, especially when you play your three out of conference games are Montana State, Northwestern, and Oklahoma State at home. Not Northwestern, sorry, Oregon State, Montana State, Oregon State, and Oklahoma State at home. That looks like a pretty easy schedule, especially since Oklahoma State basically doesn't do NIL anymore. So I think Oregon will probably have, I think they're a team that's going to end up having a better record than they actually might be, but we'll see. And maybe Dante Moore really comes around and he's like this new weapon that we hadn't seen before. Last thoughts first to you, Upper West Side.
I think it all hinges on one thing between potentially somehow being 10-2, and that is the O-line. Can they stay healthy? I think I'm just gonna, I like to make predictions. I have no proof of this. Not, I do have a little bit of proof in the fact that Hansen, our O-line coach, had a really good track record, in my opinion, from the past. I really like it. I've heard good things in camp. I've heard the line is playing more physical. I've heard that they I saw some of those. I saw a few of the one-on-one drills. It doesn't prove any. It doesn't prove. I have to make a guess, and I like to, go out on a limb occasionally and see, like, here's what I think. I'm going to project this out, even though I don't have, some of it's a hunch or whatever I think. So I think with no injuries on the O-line, yeah, the team could go maybe 10-2. With one or two injuries, it's going to make a difference. And if they're not at the right time in that middle game stretch, for example, you get like the center out, forget it. One or two of those players out, then you get like four injuries, you're talking 500 or 5-7 or something, because you're just not going to be able to run the ball. So I think we have pretty good depth everywhere. We've got a bunch of quarterbacks too, or at least, we have three quarterbacks who can probably play. So that O-line, it's got to stay healthy. They got to somehow get lucky and have like one injury on the year, or a few guys just banged up for two or three games. But you can't have three or four guys banged up in that middle stretch, or you're going to drop all those games, because you're going to need to run the ball, and you'll even need to pass block too. You need good offensive linemen to pass block. Lincoln certainly does. We saw that, come to roost last year when our pass blocking was really, really poor. So I'm just praying that somehow we get lucky and don't have any injuries at all on the O-line. So that's what it comes down to. I'll go out on a limb and say that no injuries on the O-line for more than like one or two games total, we go 10-2. But more likely we have normal injuries and maybe four losses, 8-4. So that's probably what's going to happen, something like that.
Nick, final thoughts. Nick, who is muted? I wonder if he.
Apologies. Can you all hear me?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, awesome. I totally agree with everything Upper West just said. I'm at 8-4 with the potential to go 10-2. The Notre Dame road game and the Oregon road game seem like the two obvious losses here, and all these other games are winnable, but don't think you can confidently pick USC in them. So the range here seems 6-6 to 10-2, and I'll go with the midpoint of that at 8-4.
Okay. Well, guys, thank everyone so much. And I'm sure we'll be back with more football talk, and we'll be back with more basketball talk. So until then, fight on, everyone.
Night.
Right on.